It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get acquainted with Project Girl, a multimedia program that helps girls and their families live healthier, happier lives by learning media literacy skills.
First, after a week of embarrassing revelations about inadequate Ebola preparedness at some U.S. hospitals and public fears mounting over a possible outbreak in the United States, President Obama announced the appointment of Ron Klain as the nation's Ebola coordinator today.
White House officials first resisted calls from Congress to name a lead figure on Ebola, but pressure built after two nurses at a Dallas-area hospital contracted the virus soon after caring for an Ebola patient who later died.
The move also coincides with breaking news today that the Pentagon is on lockdown as it investigates a possible Ebola case on its grounds.
Emma Roller joins us now. She's staff correspondent for the National Journal. She's also a former Badger, by the way, having graduated from the UW-Madison. Emma, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
So what do we know about this new, he's not really technically called a czar, I think, but about Ron Klain, who's going to coordinate Ebola efforts?
Right. Today in a press conference, Josh Earnest sort of tried to correct people and say, well, he's not a czar, he's an emergency response coordinator, but you can call him whatever you want. But this title of czar has been used by the U.S. government, you know, going back at least to the Nixon administration. Probably the biggest example is the AIDS czar, who was first put in place in 1993 as a point person to combat the AIDS outbreak. And the Obama administration recently tapped Douglas Brooks as the most recent AIDS czar, who is HIV positive. So this most recent news sort of coincides with that, because people within the Obama administration are, you know, even going so far as to compare the Ebola outbreak to potentially have the same spreading power as AIDS.
So Ron Klain has been a chief of staff to two vice presidents now, I gather, Al Gore and Joe Biden. It sounds like he is more of a politics and management guy than a health guy. Is there a sense in Washington that's more what we need on this issue?
Right. Some people were sort of surprised by this pick because, you know, he's not a health official. He's not a doctor. He is coming from the political realm. Like you said, he served as chief of staff to Al Gore and Joe Biden. He is a veteran Democratic operative. So he seemed like sort of a strange choice for the Obama administration to make. But the Obama administration's take is that he will use that political experience he has to coordinate the more administrative effort to respond to the Ebola threat.
You know, the White House had originally resisted calls to have a czar or coordinator in place. Why this turnaround? Why did Obama concede to appointing a coordinator?
Right. So it looks like the U.S. government has been reluctant in general to, you know, sort of try to, they don't want to induce panic, pretty much. So I think that may be an underlying reason for why they were reluctant to name a specific point person here, but now have realized that, you know, it's grown to the point where, yes, they should have this person in place. And a similar parallel is with the travel ban. A lot of members of Congress, especially Republicans, are calling for a travel ban from West Africa to the U.S., and that could be another tricky subject for the Obama administration to deal with, because up until now, they've said, no, we're not going to do a travel ban. This is not enough of a significant risk to merit that. But that means that if they were to put a travel ban in place, that could spark some panic.
Now, looking at the history of czars, or whatever they may be called at the time, how much are they granted power to tackle whatever issue they're facing? How much have they been figureheads?
It's a bit of a murky position. Like I said, it's sort of a catch-all term for a point person on a specific issue. A lot of times it's to deal with a crisis that the administration is going through. I mentioned the AIDS crisis, but there have been, you know, czars appointed for crises as disparate as the Asian carp invasion in the Great Lakes, which I'm sure you guys are all very familiar with, to Y2K. In 1999, Bill Clinton appointed a czar to, you know, oversee any potential problems with the year 2000 interfering with computers.
Now, there's been some of the criticism of the Obama administration has been on the lines of, okay, you've got a CDC director, you've got these health people, but it doesn't seem like they're showing a lot of urgency. Nobody's there to light a fire under their butts in a way. And when I think of a job like chief of staff at a high level position, I think they're the people who go out and shake people up and make sure mm-hmm. that they have things, that they're keeping tabs on things. Is that what you see Ron Klain doing in this position?
Right. I think that's exactly right. I'm not sure if that's what's going to happen, but I certainly think that's what the Obama administration was thinking when they put him in this position. He, again, is not someone with public health experience. He is someone with vast political experience who will not be afraid to crack heads if necessary and, you know, sort of whip people into shape in the response to this.
What do you see? What's the talk about some challenges he'll face in this new role?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are many challenges. There's, you know, going from coordinating with the CDC to Homeland Security, who Ron Klain will be reporting to. Some have expressed concern that there's not a clear enough chain of command here, that, you know, this czar position, there won't be a clear enough order of where he's reporting to. But aside from that, you know, dealing with congressional reaction, dealing with public outcry, the potential for public panic, aside from, you know, just the pure health concerns about the disease spreading.
And do you see this as partly an attempt to minimize that panic? You had said that part of the resistance to appointing this position was to mm-hmm. not, you know, make people panic and not take it so seriously. Is this an answer to the sense of confusion that people are having about the administration's response?
Sure. Well, I think that the response has been sort of incremental. At first, some Republicans were calling for Dr. Tom Frieden, the director of the CDC, to resign, just as Julie Pearson resigned a few weeks ago over the Secret Service scandal. But now it seems that people have moved on to saying, okay, we need this, you know, point person in place, but still pushing for the travel ban. So it seems like people's response has been sort of incremental of, we need to get rid of the CDC director. No, we need to implement this person. Okay, now we need to, you know, enact a travel ban.
Have we heard response from Congress yet on this appointment? Are people happy, critical, wait and see?
Mm-hmm. There's been pretty disparate response. You get, you get reactions from someone like Marco Rubio saying, yes, it's important to have a specific person overseeing the administration response, to Ted Cruz, who has been saying, we don't need an Ebola czar. What we need is presidential leadership.
Now, you're there in D.C. I want to get your take. We had heard about this possible risk at the Pentagon, a lockdown. The USA Today, I understand, is reporting that this person does not have Ebola. That's what we're hearing. Appeared to have been a false alarm. We'll be waiting for more details on that. But mm-hmm. you being in Washington, were people getting jumpy about this today?
You know, people being in Washington and being at the sort of center of action, people, of course, get a little on edge about something like this. But I think that this particular instance is sort of confusing, because at first it said that this woman arrived at the Pentagon by bus, and she began vomiting on the bus around 9 a.m. here. And she claimed to have been from Liberia or West Africa, but now is saying that, you know, she doesn't have a passport. And so it's just a confusing story, and I'm trying to not to jump to conclusions about it, basically.
Well, later in the show today, we'll be talking about media coverage of issues related to Ebola. Maybe this will come up there, too. Emma, thanks so much mm-hmm. for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Emma Roller. She's a staff correspondent for the National Journal. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
Girls, particularly middle school and high school girls, are a big target when it comes to product marketing. Messages about ideal body size, hair texture, makeup hit girls hard at a time when they can be especially vulnerable.
That's where Project Girl comes in. The multimedia program uses writing, art, music, and more to help girls process the messages that bombard them every day and can influence their happiness and self-esteem. One creation from Project Girl puts it this way.
One day at school, I found myself in the lunchroom eating alone. So I went home and I looked in the mirror and I realized that I wasn't a real trendsetter. I needed some lasting solutions. I saw that my lashes didn't flutter and my lips had no pucker, so I built and separated some seriously fabulous lashes without a clump in sight by using Revlon's Be Fabulous Mascara. Plus, I created instantly plump lips with Sally Hansen's Lip Inflation Tints. Now, my eyes and smile are smoking.
Kelly Park Snyder joins us now. She's a writer, multimedia artist, and the co-founder of Project Girl. Her work explores contemporary cultural and social issues to educate communities, stimulate dialogue, and create social change. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us a bit about what we just heard. What are you getting at that with that one?
You know, it makes me laugh when I hear that because I remember when, you know, the origin of when that was created, and Jane Bartel, who's the co-founder of Project Girl, and I were just rummaging through some magazines. And so as you hear that, it sounds all so goofy, but we were basically just pulling out marketing slogans from various magazines and putting them together and coming up with this idea to create this animation. So, you know, historically, our identities were typically created through, you know, we learned about them through our families, through our histories. We've learned about them through the interest in the things that we love. But marketers, they want to create our identities for us based on the products that they sell. And you know, if you talk to young people nowadays, they know more about, you know, about celebrities' lives than some of their neighbors' lives. And so the whole idea of that, animation is just, you know, the young girl goes to the mall, and she goes in the mall in pursuit of happiness. And it's like this carrot that's dangling in front of her, and that, you know, that's their game. The game is that they want to focus in on your vulnerabilities as a young person, and that's why they target kids. And then as they do that, they want you to feel okay about yourself, but not great, because what they really want you to do is buy their products. And so by boxing kids in, you know, targeting them to shop at various stores creates this identity, and it really has nothing to do with them at all. It just has something to do with the clothes that they're wearing on their body. But at the end of that animation, what happens is the young girl goes to the mall. She goes to buy all of these products in pursuit of happiness. And at the end, she realizes that, you know, it's that inner joy that is far more important than that outward appearance that comes mm-hmm. from buying products.
Right. And that's the core message of Project Girl, certainly part of it. When did you get the idea for Project Girl and decide that something like this was needed?
Well, you know, as an artist, I like to combine two things that I care about, art and creating change. And at the time, I had three daughters who were in middle school, and I just looked at how complicated their lives had become. And so I just started asking questions. You know, why do young people think they have to be sexualized so soon? You know, why are we so dissatisfied with the way we look? You know, why do we feel like we need to go buy things, you know, to be happy? Why are young girls having a difficult time getting along? A lot of questions. And a lot of research went into it. And then as Jane and I went through and connected with many experts and leaders in the field, it seemed that there had been some significant changes, and those changes had to do with media. So we gathered up a group of girls, probably the most diverse, wonderful group of girls in Madison. This was roughly 12 years ago. And the girls got together, and they were the advisors, because we knew this was important. But we also understood that we had to say this in a way that young people would connect to this. So, you know, using art has always been the way that I have learned. And so using art, that was the vehicle that attracted the girls to the project. But it was also the art that helped them learn how to express themselves, to think about these issues. And then the art is their forceful reaction, a pushback against what, in telling people, it's a pushback and reflecting what young girls really care, not you know, mediated and Hollywood profit-driven sort of messages. So we the defining difference about Project Girl is that we expect girls to be the change. Through their art, they are reformers, they're producers of real art that real girls care about.
Why do you think girls are so vulnerable to marketing messages like the ones that we heard in that ad? And maybe it's not girls, just girls anymore. Maybe it's young kids in general.
You know, it is young kids in general. Initially, we talked with girls primarily, but we're working with boys all the time. And it's because, you know, $18 billion is marketed towards young people. They have bypassed, the marketers have bypassed adults, and they're targeting young people because they assume they're vulnerable. They're counting on them to nag their parents because they influence over $700 billion of spending. And there's also 52 million young people under the age of 12. So that's a huge target. Marketers are going after young people. But the other thing is just the saturation with the technology advancements. You know, there's media everywhere, and young people are interacting with it and seeing roughly 3,000 media messages a day, which is a huge change from even, 30 years ago.
What did you hear from the girls that you worked with about how these ads and these messages were affecting their lives and their self-esteem and their relationships?
Well, you know, there's so much body dissatisfaction, and 80% of all women are dissatisfied with their bodies. So, you know, that's one of the issues. An issue that I really feel strong about is just the difficulties that girls are having in getting along. And, you know, and I can be working with a group of girls and 200 girls in an auditorium talking about, you know, this. And if I ask those young girls, can you give me an example of girls, you know, being good to each other, girls being trustworthy towards each other, a few hands will go up. And then I ask that same group of girls, you know, what about relationships that aren't good? Girls who are stabbing each other in the back, girls who are being, you know, competing all about boys, girls who, and every hand goes up. And so, you know, what's happening is that because of the saturation of those types of stories, I really believe that is normalizing some of these behaviors for girls. But I want to be specific in saying that, you know, those are media driven stories. But when I work with young girls, they're amazing. They're wonderfully creative, they're complex. You know, one of the things that they've taught me is that they're so tired of being bystanders and that they are really great change makers and they want to get engaged and make a difference. And I see this every day. But if you were to watch the media shows, you know, you'd get a totally different sort of perspective on girls.
Well, how do they do that? How do they work through those messages and affect positive change in their own lives and in the lives of their friends and their families?
Well, you know, we do this in all kinds of ways. In fact, we even work with first graders through a children's picture book. But, you know, for an example, we would come into a school and we would work with middle school girls and we would do after school programmings, or we could do programming during the day, and we could do this with boys as well. And as we work with them and we go through our curriculum that was developed, an art-based, art-integrated curriculum, the young people, they learn a lot. They begin to think. They begin to dialogue. They create art. And through that art, then they have an exhibition in their school. And then those middle schoolers, they're the leaders. They're the change makers. They're the ones that will then be talking to the younger kids as docents, giving young people an opportunity to learn what they have learned. You know, and so it's this circle of change, and it's this circle of leadership where everybody has an opportunity to be a part of the change, and it's young people teaching young people. You know, and that's such a wonderful story because we hear so many stories about kids just doing all these terrible things, but, you know, the stories that that we're creating are stories about young people who are the change that this world really needs to see.
Well, the presence of advertising, it's huge. It's everywhere. It's hard to escape it unless you go completely off the grid in terms of media. So how does someone, you know, do that if part of what they want to do is remove themselves from the line of those messages?
Yeah, well, our approach is never to preach at young people and say, you know, you can't watch this. Because, you know, what we want young people to do is to learn to interrogate and to learn to be more critical. They've grown up in this culture, so they don't really see this as being bad. You know, we can all look back and see historical frameworks and see how things have changed. But young people, you know, it's a little bit more difficult. But, you know, to me, you know, the fact that young people are interacting with media more than they're interacting in the schools just proves the fact that we need to have in our public schools, we need to have media literacy as part of the curriculum.
We're talking right now with Kelly Parks Snyder. She's a writer, multimedia artist, and the co-founder of Project Girl.
Her work explores contemporary cultural and social issues to educate communities. And we want to hear from you now. As a parent, how do you help your daughter or your boys, for that matter, deal with this constant bombardment of media messages? If you're a kid yourself, what do you think about all the ads you see, the stories you see? Does it look like real life to you? Is positive self-esteem challenging for girls in particular? Why do you think that is? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to Kelly Parks Snyder. She's a writer, multimedia artist, and the co-founder of Project Girl. Her work explores contemporary cultural and social issues to educate communities, stimulate dialogue, and create social change.
Here's a clip from one of the Project Girl programs.
We are girls, middle school girls. We are your daughters, your granddaughters, your nieces, your students, your best friend's child. We are the next generation, your legacy, a reflection of the world we were born into and the hope for a better future for all of us. We are also targets. As a market segment, we are worth an estimated $150 billion a year to corporate America. Advertisers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars each year to try and shape and influence us in order to sell us their products. Their messages are defining the way we view ourselves and those around us, affecting our health, our relationships, and how happy we are each and every day. Most of us don't even realize what's going on, how our lives are being controlled.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent or a teacher, do you agree? Do you see these kids as targets of the mass media, of marketers? What kind of messages are being sent to kids? If you are in that age group, in middle school, high school, or recently outgrown out of high school, what did those messages tell you? How did they change the lives of you and your friends? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kelly, one thing that Project Girl tries to do is to teach girls to cultivate positive friendships, positive relationships. And this is something that is surprisingly hard to get a handle on sometimes during these difficult, especially middle school years. What have you seen with that?
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, talking to girls and about being an ally, this is one of the things I like to do, is, you know, an ally doesn't mean that you're best friends. It doesn't mean that you hang out together. But an ally is somebody that supports, is somebody who supports each other. An ally is somebody who supports each other's differences. An ally is somebody that can help you broaden, you know, who you are and be okay with that. And an ally can be somebody that's protective. When, you know, in a time in these young girls' lives when they really need each other, you know, they're really, you know, pitted against each other through the advertising stories, you know, like I discussed earlier about girls not getting along. And so the other idea, you know, I don't really like to talk about bullying because, I mean, everybody's a bully, a victim. We've all been everything all the at times in our lives. But more of about like, how do you use your power? You know, how do you use your power to make a difference in the world? You know, if we want young people to value themselves, then give them something to do that's worth doing. And so social change is one of those activities. It gives young people meaning. It gives purpose to their life. It gives them that rare privilege where they can make a difference in somebody else's lives. And that's always the hook that gets these girls into these projects. I'll never forget years ago, when we say we are girl-led, a lot of programs say that, you know, but being girl-led is a lot of work because, you know, it takes a lot of work to teach your mentors to then work with young girls, and it's very collaborative. But I sent out an email to a few girls that I knew who could lead in Madison, and it was a week before school started, and we met at a high school, and one of those girls picked up that email that I'd sent her, made a Facebook page about it, sent it out over Facebook, and surprisingly, 40 girls walked in to that room. 40 girls who were there. There were no carrots. There were no community service hours. It was like, I'm looking for girls who want to make a difference in the lives of younger girls. And they all marched in that very hot evening, and I will never forget that. And that's what I see every day.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We have Mark on the line with us in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hello. My comment, I think, real quickly is that, yes, absolutely, I believe people market to kids, very clearly market positively and negatively. And I'm an educator, and I get, I think, upset and a little offended by some of the negative images and messages that I see go out to teenagers. So for anybody to ask the question, do marketers go towards kids? Without question.
Okay, thank you so much for your thoughts on that, Mark. And you know, Mark, seeing advertisers going after kids, is there a right way, or you know, maybe do we need to look to the marketers and advertisers themselves and ask for reform from that end instead of expecting kids to become savvier and savvier consumers?
Yeah, I have more faith in the kids than I do in the corporate America, to be honest. I mean, there's so many profit-driven businesses out there, and I'm not saying they're all bad, and I'm not saying all marketing's bad. However, it's unconscionable some of the ways marketers target young people, and you know, and to me, that is a social justice issue because they really take advantage of their vulnerabilities. They you know, millions of dollars are spent studying brains and how brains react to various market slogans. They know what they're doing. I mean, one of the reasons why we bypassed parents and went to kids is because marketers, that's what they do, and they know what they're doing, and they're very effective about it.
Well, thank you for that call. Let's go next to Chris in Greendale. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
What do you think?
I have more of a little bit of a comment, but more of a question. You know, it's been a while since I was in middle school or, you know, like a teenager, but I can remember as early as like 2000 when I was in middle school, you know, being obsessed with the idea of like everybody seemed to want like six pack abs and stuff. And like, we're in middle school. And I was just wondering, like, I definitely see like males, like young boys and teenage boys being sort of victimized, I guess, by corporate America in the same ways that, that young girls are. And I was just wondering if there's any sort of equivalent, like, organizations at all that address the issue with boys. Because I feel like there's, you know, there's a lot of organizations that sort of strive to empower, like, you know, young girls, but it doesn't seem to be a lot addressing the issue with boys.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your thoughts there, Chris. And I'm also curious, you can speak to Chris's questions, but is that a change that you've seen? Project Girl has been around for a while. Do you see it increasingly incorporating boys, that the marketing machine and advertisers going after kids of both genders?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. You know, 12 years ago, we weren't talking to boys about body objectification for boys or body dissatisfaction with boys. I mean, if you just start looking at the models and how emaciated they are, there is a significant increase in eating disorders for males nowadays. And you know, we do, Chris, work with boys, and many of the conversations are the same. I just add, you know, I add privilege. I add how they use their power. I, you know, some of the stereotypes of men or boys, you know, as they're either a sports guy or they're a slacker. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting how then we're having some of these issues that we're seeing in the schools nowadays. One area that I'm really interested in is the mediated images towards African-American boys, because they're hugely detrimental, because we live in such a racialized society, and they are so detrimental to their life chances. And the media images, and so I'm working with a group of boys right now, and they're teaching me a lot about what it's like to interact with all of those messages and how untrue and unfair that those messages are. There was something in the Isthmus just the other day. It's called Builder Boy. Is a group that's an organization in Madison here, and I don't know all that much about it, but it sounded like a great opportunity. But you should contact me if you're interested in, you know, getting involved in something like this.
And what's your website?
Our website is www.projectgirl.org.
Great. Thank you for the call, Chris. And I'm going to go to William joining us in Madison. Hi, William.
Hello.
What are your thoughts?
My thoughts on this, so to kind of frame it, I own a marketing agency in Madison, and I have a background in psychology, so this really sparked big. I also have two little sisters who are 8 and 11. You know, I love them so much, and so this really resonates with me that, yeah, I'd like to throw a couple things out there. First, you know, I hear language like the marketing machine and corporate America. These things dehumanize the conversation, and they really defer responsibility to some kind of magical entity that might exist if only it could, and then it'll solve the problem. When really this is conversations like what we're having right now, bringing up the idea and realizing that, you know, the marketers who are creating these messages, they're people too. They have mothers and sisters and daughters, et cetera. You know, also today, more than ever before, these targets are really part of shaping the message themselves. And I'm talking about social media. And so, you know, I really liked what the young girl said there about how they are a reflection. Marketing is doing the same thing, too. And so, you know, I would want to hear from some of the other callers and from you guys, you know, what should we do about this? That there are these messages, that these things do have a real impact, and that the impact is at scale.
Thank you so much for your thoughts. I appreciate your feedback, William. Thank you for calling. And William talking about making this a dialogue between the kids we're talking about, and that they're part of the equation, part of the culture, and that it's really a two-way street he's describing here.
Yeah, you're right. But I think the problem is we aren't having these conversations with young people. I often feel like the conversations that I'm having with young people, nobody's having these conversations, which is why, going back to this, really needs to be implemented into our public schools. You know, when I'm out talking around the country about this, people would ask, how do I talk to younger audiences about this? And 2 years ago, I published a book. It's called Zillia Modern Day Fable, and it's a picture book. And everybody thought there was no way you can talk to first graders about media literacy. I do it all the time, and they're wonderful at it. It's just a little bit of a different dialogue. It's a different, and what I focus in on them and those younger audiences is making their identity so strong, you know, and that in convincing them that they are just great the way they are. And so then if they feel that way, they don't need all of this stuff that's being marketed towards them, and they can push back and they can learn to deconstruct it themselves, because it's difficult. You know, we're asking people to interrogate a culture that they've grown up in. And I said that earlier. So, you know, we got to be having these conversations.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Kelly Park Snyder, writer, multimedia artist, and the co-founder of Project Girl.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
News guy Noah Ovshinsky is back with us for our state news roundup. He drops by every week at this time. Today, a look at the top stories of the week, including the latest results from the Marquette poll and the races for governor and attorney general. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. So this week, more confirmation that the race for governor is tight. What did we see?
Well, that's right. It's been tight for weeks. With this latest Marquette poll, it suggests this race, in fact, is very, very, very tight. This week's poll has both Governor Walker and Mary Burke tied among likely voters. And this is a pretty big change from the previous poll, which was released 2 weeks ago, which had Walker up by 5 points among likely voters.
So where inside the numbers did we see those changes?
The change, at least in part, are due to the independents in the state. In the last poll, Walker led this particular group 53% to Burke's 40%. And this week now, 2 weeks later, the margin shrunk and actually flipped with these independent voters. Burke is now leading with this group 45-44.
I've seen responses from partisans on either side complaining about either the poll 2 weeks ago or the poll this week being an outlier. But this race is close. It has been all along. Is it unusual that it's this close with just a few weeks until Election Day?
According to experts, to some extent it is. Pollster Charles Franklin, who conducts the Marquette poll, has said that he's surprised that no candidate has actually started breaking away or has sustained a lead for any period of time. And right now, neither of those things have really happened.
So what is it? Is it something about the state, something about the candidates? Why is this still so close?
Well, Charles Franklin told the Journal Sentinel that he thinks one reason is that people have a lot of practice, essentially, thinking of Walker as a candidate. You know, they have already made up their mind. I mean, this is the third time in 4 years people are going to the polls to decide whether or not they want him as a governor. And, of course, traditionally, gubernatorial candidates, you know, I'll call it, you know, they face less electoral scrutiny, I guess.
Third time in 4 years. You know, I know the numbers, but I hadn't thought of it in that way.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have either voted for him or voted against him in the last 4 years. And so I think people's minds, for the most part, are set.
Now, again, beneath the main numbers, is there anything else striking about what we discovered?
Yeah, if you dig into the numbers a bit, I think the other interesting bit of polling has to do with the gender gap. And the headline here is that it's actually largely disappeared. In the last poll, this is again 2 weeks ago, men supported Walker by a 28-point margin. And women favored Burke by a 14-point margin. That was 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. In this latest poll, men favored Walker by only a 2% margin, and Burke's lead with women shrunk to only 1%. So that's a pretty dramatic change on both counts.
Now, turning to the other big statewide race, the race for attorney general in Wisconsin.
Right. So like the governor's race, this one is also going to be probably a nail biter. According to the latest poll, Brad Schimmel and Susan Happ are dead even among likely voters at 42%. Each. Now, where the race differs from the governor's race is in the percentage of undecided voters. We've talked about in the governor's race that stands at about 4%, give or take. But in the race for attorney general, the number of undecided voters jumps significantly to 16%.
So why so many more undecided voters in the attorney general race?
Well, there are still a lot of people out there who frankly don't know enough about either candidate to have an opinion. And that number stands at 74% for Brad Schimmel and 72% for Susan Happ. And those numbers, frankly, have only changed, you know, slightly since the last poll. So there are an awful lot of people who just don't know enough about these candidates to have an opinion.
That's not as high profile a race as the race for governor.
It's not as high profile. And, you know, name recognition comes into play here. You know, they simply aren't that well known outside, I'll call them sort of the areas of influence, I guess. You know, in Brad Schimmel's case, that's Waukesha County. In Susan Happ's case, it's Jefferson County.
Are you working election night this year?
I am.
Caffeine up, my man. You're late. Really, really late. Well, I'm getting back now away from the Marquette poll. What's some of the latest news going on here in the governor's race?
Yeah, so one of the big stories really of the week for me actually has to do with what Mary Burke told the Journal Sentinel editorial board earlier this week. And she really began, really for the first time, to distance herself from former Governor Jim Doyle. As you might remember, she served as the Secretary of Commerce in his administration.
And so why bring Doyle up at this point? That in a way, she might want to look at that as ancient history.
Right. Well, Governor Walker has spent a lot of time during the campaign attacking Burke for her connection to Doyle. Governor Walker has basically said a vote for Burke would essentially mean a return to the Doyle era, a time when there were, you know, large deficits and higher unemployment.
So why bring this up now, just a few weeks off from Election Day?
Well, in the closing weeks of this race, you know, I think this was a very clear attempt by Mary Burke to blunt that particular line of attack that the governor has been using.
So how did she try to separate? What kind of messaging did she use to try to separate herself from the previous Democratic regime here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so Burke criticized the former governor on a few different fronts. One, for raiding the transportation fund to pay for other things. And she also criticized him for the tuition hikes of 5% that were commonplace at that point.
Okay, and anything else on some of the core, you know, jobs or tax and spending issues?
Yeah, Burke also criticized Doyle for raising income taxes on the wealthiest Wisconsinites.
So a Democrat criticizing a Democrat for raising taxes on the wealthy.
It's a bit unusual, and as Sean Johnson pointed out in his reporting this week, you know, she's criticizing Doyle for raising taxes on the wealthiest. At the same time, she's criticizing Walker for offering tax breaks for the rich. So kind of an unusual situation there.
Well, before we move away from elections, Noah, I'll remind people to join us Friday tonight at 7 for the second of two gubernatorial debates sponsored by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. It features Governor Scott Walker and Mary Burke. That's the WA gubernatorial debate tonight at 7 on WPR. People can also follow election news over at wisconsinvote.org. So another story outside of the direct world of politics here, getting a lot of attention from Milwaukee, the latest in a police-involved shooting there.
Right. So this is a case that has been really closely watched by many people in Milwaukee and elsewhere. And just to rewind a little bit, Officer Christopher Manny of the Milwaukee Police Department shot and killed an unarmed black man, Dontre Hamilton, during a struggle in a city park back in April. The killing touched off a series of protests in Milwaukee. You know, the use of force, especially when involving people who are, you know, potentially mentally ill, has been in the news a lot lately. And the community has been waiting to see what would happen to the police officer who was involved.
Yeah, definitely a hot topic, not just in Wisconsin, but on the national level as well. So what happened this week?
Well, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn announced that Officer Manny had been fired essentially for failing to follow the proper procedure.
How so?
Well, Flynn said that Manny, you know, correctly identified Hamilton as somebody who was emotionally disturbed, but should not have tried to pat down Hamilton when he did. It was that pat down that was sort of the catalyst for the struggle that eventually led to the shooting.
Now, what have we heard in response to this?
Well, the Hamilton family, the family said, you know, they are glad that Manny has been fired, but Dontre's brother, Nathaniel, would like to see the Milwaukee County DA file criminal charges against
right.
the officer.
And that's the big question mark still out there, whether criminal charges would be filed. Where is that now?
No word yet from DA John Chisholm. A new state law requires outside agencies to investigate officer-involved shootings. And that investigation is still being reviewed at the moment by the DA's office.
And I've seen in the news today police unions and a city councilman challenger to the mayor of Milwaukee are angry about this.
Yeah.
Saying it was cowardly to
fire
this officer.
The police union was not happy with the firing of the officer.
Okay, and I know Chuck Kornbach over in Milwaukee will continue following this down the road.
He has and will continue to, yep.
All right, Noah, as always, thanks for joining us and bringing us up to date.
It was good to be here. Thanks for having me.
That was Noah Ovshinsky. He's our news guy here on Central Time. The official title, though, WPR's Assistant News Director. He joins us each week to catch up on the big stories going on here in Wisconsin.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Keep track of what we're doing. Share your thoughts on some of the big stories of the day over at the Central Time Facebook page. You can always tweet us also at Central Time WPR. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.